corporate services such as Google. For more information, contact us at kumbit.org or email at info@kumbit.org. That's K-O-U-M-B-I-T. We are
welcome to the October 29th edition of Dromo Text. Tonight we have a couple of poets on the bill. The first one we'll hear is Tracy K. Smith, an American poet and educator, who was the 22nd Poet Laureate of the United States from 2017 to 2019. She has published 4 collections of poetry, winning the Pulitzer Prize in 2011 for her work Life on Mars. Her memoir, Ordinary Light, was published in 2015. And so, here she is. This is from the University of California's Lunch Poem television series.
This program is a presentation of UCTV for educational and non-commercial use only.
It's a pleasure to welcome Tracy Smith here. She grew up, or at least partly grew up, in Northern California, and she actually worked for a period in the Bancroft Library. So we're, in a way, welcoming one of our own back, though we didn't get her at Berkeley. In fact, I'm afraid she got a Stegner Fellowship and spent time at Stanford. She went to Harvard and to Columbia. She did work at Stanford, and she's published 2 enormously striking books. One of the things that's unusual about them is that their titles are actually sort of what they're about. The first book was called The Body's Questions. It's a book about the body's questions. it's quite gorgeous. Saudade, the longings of, for place, for love, for order, for a morally comprehensible universe are in that book. The means tend to be understated. There's a sense in the poems, and she articulates in the poems the power of waiting to hear what the poem has to say. And Duende seemed to me, when I saw the title, like, oh, that would be the next place to go, from the questions that desire and longing and the nature of language provoke in you to a fiercer version of that. And when I opened the book and started to look through it, the thing that was most striking is what dark historical material she goes to in the book. Let me begin. I don't want to take a lot of time. I want you to hear her, but let me read you just a bit of what she has to say about Duende, which was, of course, Federico Garcia Lorca's borrowing of a musician's concept and a gypsy concept to talk about where poetry comes from. This is Tracy Smith. We read poems because they change us, and our reasons for writing them hover around that same fact. A poem, a good poem, speaks to and from a place that belongs to us, that elusive pitch of being some might call the soul, the psyche, the sub or unconscious. We believe it's there because we feel it working, but we're powerless to tell it when or how or even why to work. Surely, as poets, most of us have discovered ways of letting go enough to embolden whatever it is that sends words and questions and inklings out from that space. It's worth reading that sentence twice because it gives you a sense of the subtle and intense qualities of her intelligence. That elusive pitch of being some might call the soul, the psyche, the sub or unconscious. We believe it's there because we feel it working, but we're powerless to tell it when or how or even why to work. Surely, as poets, most of us have discovered ways of letting go enough to embolden whatever it is that sends words and questions and inklings out from that space. And the best readers know that that place is where poems go when they hit us hard, teach us, reach home. The Spanish poet Federico Garcia Lorca named the keeper of that space the duende, daemon, hobgoblin, mischief maker, guardian of, she quotes Lorca, the mystery, the roots fastened in the mire that we all know and all ignore. Unlike the muse or angel, which exists beyond or above the poet, the duende sleeps deep within the poet and asks to be awakened and wrestled, often at great cost. Please welcome Tracy Smith.
Thank you so much. I'm really thrilled to be here because it really does feel like kind of coming home in a way, and excited to see some familiar faces in the audience. So I thought I would start with a few poems from the Duende. I actually feel like I now have to because I forgot to bring a copy of the book with me, and then my family went on this chase tracking down their copies that they had lent out. And so I have a copy now, and only to see that there are stacks of them right there. But I will begin with the title poem. And this poem, there are a couple of moments where quotations from flamenco songs come in, and maybe they will be apparent. The Duende. The earth is dry, and they live wanting, each with a small reservoir of furious music heavy in the throat. They drag it out, and with nails in their feet, coax the night into being. Brief believing, a skirt shimmering with sequins and lies. And in this night that is not night, each word is a wish, each phrase a shape their bodies ache to fill. I'm going to braid my hair, braid many colors into my hair. I'll put a long braid in my hair and write your name there. They defy gravity to feel tugged back, the clatter, the mad slap of landing. And not just them, not just the ramshackle family, the tíos primitos, not just the bailaor whose heels have notched and hammered time so the hours flow in place like a tin river, marking only what once was. Not just the voices scraping against the river, nor the hands nudging them farther, fingers like blind birds, palms empty, echoing. Not just the women with sober faces and flowers in their hair, the ones who dance as though they're burying memory one last time beneath them. And I hate to do it here, to set myself heavily beside them. Not now that they've proven the body a myth, parable for what not even language moves quickly enough to name. If I call it pain and try to touch it with my hands, my own life, it lies still and the music thins, a pulse felt for through garments. If I lean into the desire it starts from, if I lean unbuttoned into the blow of loss after loss, love tossed into the ecstatic void, it carries me with it farther, to chords that stretch and bend like light through colored glass. But it races on toward shadows where the world I know and the world I fear threaten to meet. There is always a road, the sea, dark hair, dolor, always a question bigger than itself. They say you're leaving Monday. Why can't you leave on Tuesday? The more I started thinking about that concept of the duende, the more it really became for me kind of a synonym for survival and maybe resistance also, not only because the usually the groups of people that are responsible for the folk traditions that we associate with terms like that are marginalized and are kind of holding on to a culture that's being threatened by maybe a larger culture, but also because I really think that the most creativity that we have kind of comes out when we need it most. And I just started thinking about so many different aspects of our everyday life as citizens where that kind of determination comes out. So that's, I think, what really began to take shape as this book developed. So I'll read a poem called Slow Burn, which I think is kind of like a domestic duende. Slow Burn. We tend toward the danger at the center, soft core teeming blue with fire. We tend toward what will singe and flare, but coil back when brought near. Sometimes we read about people pushed there and left to recover. They don't. Come out mangled or not at all. Minds flayed by visions no one can fathom. I have a cousin who haunts the basement of my aunt's house, drinking her liquor. The air around him is cold, and he swings at it, working himself into a sweat like a boxer or an addict. Sometimes he comes upstairs to eat her food, feeding the thing inside him. We laugh, thinking laughter will make us safe. Then we go home and lie down in our lives. Sometimes, when my thoughts won't sit still, I imagine Marcus down there, awake in the dark, hands fisted in his lap, or upturned, open, in what might be a kind of prayer. I'm certain the same thing dragging his heart drags ours, only he's not afraid to name it, can call it up into the room and swear at it, or let it rest there on the couch beside him. Till his head slumps onto his chest and the TV bruises the walls with unearthly light. This poem is called Theft, and I'm just going to read you the epigraph. It's based on an interview that I read several years ago with a man named John Dahl. And in 1963, John Dahl, a Ho-Chunk Indian, was taken from his mother's home as part of a federal project to reduce poverty in Native American communities. He moved from foster home to foster home, haunted by recurring dreams and unsure of his own history. Years later, he was located by members of his tribe. And I think it was actually something like 20 years later. And the word Ho-Chunk means people of the big voice. Theft. The world shatters through mother's black hair. I breathe smoke, tincture of sudden berries. Mother covers my eyes, but this heat is inside. It trickles out, a map of hot tears across my face, and rivers, my own rivers, pushing out from the desert between my legs. Frantic birds lift off, and their flight takes me. I float above dark thickets, thick air, above voices that rush and rise, a mad cloak. Sirens in my mother's mouth, sirens in the far corners of the flat black globe. I wake again and again, ears ringing, eyes dry. One night when our bellies groan, I quiet myself watching bare branches scratch against the moon. If night has a voice, it is surely this wind in these trees, is surely mother's heavy shoes climbing the steps, trampling leaves. I'm the only one who knows what that voice means to say. It is trying to tell us to hurry, but it does not say for what. One brother twirls a pencil over a notebook. Answers he's erased hover like stalled ghosts. He shakes his head. All wrong. Another laughs at the TV. We are many, each in his own now. I've never thought to cross from mine to theirs, but I've held my hand inches from my brother's back and felt his heat. A knock at the door. The walls cough. Again. And mother doesn't ignore it. I feel what the moon must feel for the branches night after night. This can't go on. Come in. Then I watch our house come undone, and mother gets smaller, and the road ahead like a serpent racing into pitch. In the station, we get blankets and a civics lesson. We get split up. All night, the drunks and devils sing. Rattle. I live in the house behind the chain link fence, with smoke stenciling the sky above the roof, in a room with three boys and a window that wheezes winter. I wear my hair shorn. The mother here leans against the kitchen counter, scrubbing forks and bowls, staring into steam. If you interrupt her, she'll surprise you with an elbow, the back of her hand. Her fist squeaks in yellow gloves. I live in Chicago, in America. We have rules. Don't flush unless necessary, and only 4 squares of tissue a day. 2 in the morning, 2 at night, or all at once, but just 4, and someone is counting. When you brush, turn the water on once, then off, then on again. Say sir and ma'am, but only when necessary. Otherwise, don't talk, and don't stare. What are you, stupid? And what kind of Indian are you? What kind? If you don't know, you must not be. This is my 8th home. I am 7. When I skip school, I get on the L and scour the city from inside, from above. I listen to the iron percussion, track soldered to track, a story that turns and returns, refuses to end. I write it down. I'm in my seat in the first car, a hologram in the window, in the battered doors, a stick figure in the chrome poles. I reach for myself, grab me by the neck. What do I hear? Time. What does it say? I can't tell. What does it sound like? It sounds angry. Why angry? Because we keep it waiting. When it's not waiting, it is always begging us to go. I get off the train, walk backwards over bridges, watch perspective diminish, watch my breath, my ideas hover and drift in perfect clouds. They'll drop eventually, mingle with a river or lake, might even one day make it back to me, as rain maybe, or a tall glass I drink quickly, blind with thirst. I shout my name into the traffic, and if my voice is big enough, someone will hear it. It will land where it needs to land, and someone will catch it and come looking. So I'm going to share some newer work. One of the things that I find that I've been thinking about lately is the genre of science fiction. And I don't know, it seems almost like a perfect metaphor for American life in a way. I guess the loneliness and unknowability of space is something that, since I don't know that much about science, I'm trying to figure out ways of understanding by way of aspects of everyday life that I do feel like I understand. So that's what's happening in these next several poems. Sci-fi. There will be no edges, but curves. Clean lines pointing only forward. History, with its hard spine and dog-eared corners, will be replaced with nuance, just like the dinosaurs gave way to mounds and mounds of ice. Women will still be women, but the distinction will be empty. Sex, having outlived every threat, will gratify only the mind, which is where it will exist. For kicks, we'll dance for ourselves, before mirrors studded with golden bulbs. The oldest among us will recognize that glow, but the word sun will have been reassigned to a standard uranium neutralizing device found in households and nursing homes. And yes, we'll live to be much older thanks to popular consensus. Weightless, unhinged, eons from even our own moon will drift in the haze of space, which will be, once and for all, scrutable and safe. The universe is a house party. The universe is expanding. Look, postcards and panties, bottles with lipstick on the rim, orphan socks and napkins dried into knots. Quickly, wordlessly, all of it whisked into file with radio waves from a generation ago, drifting to the edge of what doesn't end, like the air inside a balloon. Is it bright? Will our eyes crimp shut? Is it molten, atomic, a conflagration of suns? It sounds like the kind of party your neighbors forget to invite you to. Bass throbbing through walls and everyone thudding around drunk on the roof. We grind lenses to an impossible strength, point them toward the future, and dream of beings we'll welcome with indefatigable hospitality. How marvelous you've come. We won't flinch at the pinprick mouths, the nubbin limbs. We'll rise, gracile, robust. Mi casa es tu casa, never more sincere. Seeing us, they'll know exactly what we mean. Of course it's ours. If it's anyone's, it's ours. The universe is a wedding. Or maybe we're the ones no one expected to show. Cousins by marriage, twice removed. Narcoleptic colleagues. The ham-fisted, cleft-tongued. Those with nowhere to go who prefer to stay home, knitting or tatting, living out whole impossible scenarios by a watery TV screen light. We've come anyway, eager for a slice of cake, eager to get dressed, get out of the house, eager to see past our own windows fogged with lace. We've brought a toaster stuck with a bow and dollar bills to pin to the groom's tie. Cameras flash. The newlyweds flicker like a constellation at the head of the aisle. A strange music rises to our ears, like coins in a drain, indecipherable as the wails before they died out. We watch, wondering if it'll last. Confetti drops like predicted weather from the sky. A couple of years ago, I bought this plane ticket to Haiti. I was going to go for Thanksgiving, and I wrote an email really excitedly to some friends there who were working for an NGO, and I got this email back that was practically in all capital letters telling me, do not come, this is a bad time, we don't travel unless we're in convoys, and you know the situation isn't really welcoming to random tourists. So I canceled the trip, but I always felt a little bit like I'd given in too easily to this idea of danger. So this poem kind of came from that. And I'm not sure if this poem is toying with the fantasy of danger in third world places or what exactly, but I'll just share it. It's called What If You'd Gone Anyway? Just to sense the liftoff, body clenched, anchored, like a stone in a fist, then light, heart in your mouth, ears agog, stomach churning away at a packet of nuts, a few sips of something with kick, wanting nothing more than to fumble like a clumsy janitor with the wrong set of keys, to pause and decipher signs like, down with the expensive life, God is good, buy something stupid. You'd have taken your first few steps through customs, past the caravan of orphaned bags on their ceaseless loop, back behind the black rubber drapes and out again like ham actors, then maybe stopped short, wondering whether anyone had seen you, whether anyone's hand closed around a sharp object deep in the pocket of a superfluous coat. If there really are people who can tell a stranger not from what you say or the mark of your shoes, but from how light behaves after it hits your skin, they're probably so good they need only walk up to you empty-handed and command, "Come with me." No threats, just fact. You have what I need. You are what I need. And knowing they're right, you obey. Fear resembles desire. Even when the message is wrong, even when someone you owe nothing leans in, handles you as if once in another life maybe you belonged to him. Sometimes now you imagine riding slumped in the back of that car as it speeds through the slums toward some dim room where you're shoved into a chair or strung up to a pipe that gurgles, "Idiot, fool," under its breath. You imagine the shadows charging in and out of the doorway, arguing protocol. They're young, hyped up on something, hungry, shouting because nobody's listening. You duck your head when they raise their fists. You stoop in this place where anyone who grows too tall is hacked right down. This poem is called Reality, and the only little detail that might be interesting is in Rome, and I'm sure in lots of other places, but in the winter there are these huge clouds of starlings that you can see in the sky, making these really beautiful sort of undulating patterns. They're pretty mesmerizing, and you can actually Google on YouTube starlings in Rome and see these film clips of this happening. So there's a reference to that toward the end of this poem. Reality. If I had to say, I'd call it the valley where a lead of foxes swirls in ambush, or the rapid loops an owl sears into the sky at dusk. It is heavy in the way starlings seem for an instant heavy as they herd and swell, their dark mass now a clot, now merely the shadow of a shape, distant, diminished, gone. A presence that slips in and out of its own name, not shy, but quick. Quicker than our way of naming what we know. Quicker than our knowing. Sometimes I'd say it seems like what sings out from what the fox drags back to its den. Or the branches where the wind hauls what the owl wrote. Sometimes it is merely the silence smudged onto the window in Rome against which someone has pressed her rapt, round face, squinting out. And I'll end with this poem, which is called Willed in Autumn. The room is red, like ourselves on the inside. We enter, and my heart ticks out its tune of soon, soon. I kneel on the bed and wait. The silence behind me is you, shallow breaths that rustle nothing. This will last. I grip the sheets, telling time to get lost. I close my eyes so the red is darker now, deep, a willed distance that backs away the faster we approach. I dream a little plot of land and 6 kid goats. Every night it rains. Every morning sun breaks through and the earth is firm again under our feet. I am writing this so it will stay true. Don't leave. Go for a while into your life, but meet me come dusk at a bar where music sweeps out from a jukebox choked with ragged bills. We'll wander back barefoot at night, carrying our shoes to save them from the rain. We'll laugh to remember all the things that slaughtered us a lifetime ago, and at the silly goats, greedy for anything soft enough to crack between their teeth. Thank you so much for coming.
And that was Tracy K. Smith reading for the first half of Drama Text this evening. Coming up is American poet Al Young, former poet laureate of California. Here he is.
I was a co-editor of a magazine called Generation as an undergraduate at the University of Michigan with another writer, undergraduate writer named Ann Doniger. And we were sophomores. I don't know how we got the position, but there we were. And it was during a period when a lot of the Korean War vets were coming back to school under the GI Bill of that time. And one such person was X.J. Kennedy. He was older than we were, and he came in there with some poems, and it was the era of the new criticism, objective, correlative, and all of that T.S. Eliot stuff. And we really were conditioned to believe that if you could understand a poem, if a poem appeared to be clear, that it couldn't be any good. We thought that it had to be cryptic, arcane in some way. So he gave us a poem called Karma. We had no idea what karma was. And so we sat there at the meeting, and we said, this is good. We gotta do this. So of course we published him. At the same time, there was a young man named Peter Zimmels. And Peter Zimmels was always fascinating to me because he just had a flair for breezy language. He would stand in the hallway and say, "Do you have a quarter as such?" And say, what do you mean by a quarter as such, Peter? He says, "I don't want 25 pennies, I don't want 2 dimes and a nickel, I don't," you get the idea. So he gave us a poem called Sundays in Democracies, and we didn't understand it, and we published it. We thought it was good. But many decades later, in fact, just a few years later, just a few years ago, I should say, I dug that poem out. I always loved the title, Sundays in Democracies, and I still couldn't understand what Peter was driving at. Now, he subsequently became a Buddhist monk in Thailand, and then he became a lyricist for the Grateful Dead. Some of you might know his name. So I just jettisoned everything he'd written and kept the title and wrote my own poem and dedicated it to him. So this is Sundays in Democracies for Peter Zimmels. For people interested in structure, it's three sonnets that are kind of interlinked. Sundays in Democracies for Peter Zimmels. Republicans, you're poor because you're ignorant of all the laws our Congress passed to cut the costs of schooling children who get tossed, nay, dumped upon society. While we do view with piety the right to life, we draw the line. Clean up your act. To woo or whine the loser class does not make sense. Let's get this straight. We never winced at taking public time to quarrel with victims, thugs, the huge immoral segment of the population in our great, God-blessed, rich, free nation. The Democrats. There was a time the GOP and all its crime got barely covered by the news, which only aired our sins and blues. What have they done for you, my friends? Is making do or making ends meet any measure of success? We back the same big business mess they do, but when we tighten your belt, we dig up Franklin Roosevelt. We've given you prosperity without their stark severity. The only thing we have to fear, Republicans. Now, is that clear? A citizen, more parties, please. More Sundays in Democracies. Each party dances, each side sings, one great big bird with two right wings. They'll boogie with you in the streets, then drag you down to dark defeats. Democracy? Look at our heroes. CEOs, billions. Labor's, zeros. Pure DNA, unspliced and spliced. If you think oil is overpriced, consider what we're going to pay for giving frequencies away. The broadcast ban. I say, let's vote. Let's kick some butt. Let's rock some boat. Thank you. When I was interviewed as one of four contenders for the position of the post of poet laureate by our governor, in the middle of the interview, we were supposed to have spoken for about 5 or 6 minutes on a late Friday afternoon, and we ended up talking for about 45 minutes. He shocked me, and I think his staff as well, by quoting large portions of the poem I'm about to give you. And I remembered, that's right, he is an actor, you know. He had memorized it. The poem, the source of the poem goes back to UC Santa Cruz. I was teaching there in an interdisciplinary course called curriculum called Community Studies, which was really very exciting. The kids would be in school for a while, and then they would have to go out and actually work and come back and write a thesis on their work experience, combining theory and practice. It's a program that's still going. And I had one older student. They still use the term non-traditional, and to me that means older and interesting. And this was a woman who had four children by two husbands, and her third husband had given her no children. So once a month she would say to me, I won't be in class, Professor Young, because it's conjugal visiting day at the Q. And I eventually got the nerve to ask her what that meant, and she told me all about it, that her husband was in prison. He'd always been there. That is, they met through correspondence. That was sort of a vogue at one time, where lots of women were, and men were meeting their mates, their spouses, future spouses, and through correspondence with prisoners. So I asked her what it was like. She said, well, it's really kind of nice because every time we see each other, it's like a honeymoon. We show each other poems we've been writing and talk about books we've been reading and make love. And, you know, they have this special meal out there in the trailer court where they have the conjugal visits. Then she said, when I get back to Santa Cruz and I'm trying to take care of my kids and get my studies and do my work, he can't mess with me, because he's locked up. So you know, the human condition just always emerges. There's a subtext of this poem which is fairly obvious, and that is California, I think, competes with Texas. I'm not sure who's ahead right now at having the most prisons, and we're building them at a very rapid rate. And the figure is still solid. Stanford tuition is about $36,000 a year these days, and that's what it costs per man and woman to keep them locked up. So it's a matter of values. Conjugal visits, and this is done presumably in her voice. By noon, we'll be deep into it, up reading out loud in bed, or in between our making love, I'll paint my toenails red. Reese say he got to change his name from Maurice to Malik. He think I need to change mine too, conversion, so to speak. I ain't no Muslim yet, I say. Besides, I like my name. Kamisha still sounds good to me. I'll let you play that game. I'd rather play with you, he say, than trip back to the 60s. The 60s, eh? I'm on his case. Then I won't do my striptease. This brother look at me and laugh. He know I love him bad, and worse, he know exactly how much lovin' I ain't had. He grabbed me by my puffed up waist and pulled me to him close. He say, I want you in my face or on my face, Miss Toes. Forgive me, high school kids, but I'm sure if you have HBO at home, you hear worse than that. What can I say? I'd lie for Reese, but I'm not quitting school. 4 miles to feed, not counting mine. Let urban studies rule. I met him in the want ads. We fell in love by mail. I say when people bring this up, wasn't no one up for sale. All these black men crammed up in jail, all this IQ on ice. While governments, bank presidents, the mafia don't think twice. They fly in dope and make real sure their hands stay nice and clean. The chump change Reese made on the street, what's that supposed to mean? For what it costs the state to keep you locked down, clothed, and fed, you could be learning Harvard stuff and brilliant skills, I said. Reese say, just kiss me one more time, then let's get down, make love, then let's devour that special meal I wish they'd serve more of. They say the third time out's a charm. I kind of think they're right. My first, he was the ace of swords, which didn't make him no knight. He gave me Zeus and Brittany. My second left me twins. This third one ain't about no luck. We're honeymooners, friends. I go see Maurice once a month while Mom's looks after things. We'd be so glad to touch again. I dance, he grins, he sings. When I get back home to my kids, schoolwork, the copy shop, ain't no way Reese can mess with me. They got his ass locked up. Some unpublished poems. It's really endlessly intriguing to me how perfectly culture reflects a society's values as they wax and wane. And I look at contemporary, you know, vernacular dance, and it's really saying something that, you know, people don't touch quite often, that they just sort of, you know, stand across from each other and jiggle around and do all these self-important, make all these self-important moves. I come from another era. Ooh, baby, baby. Ooh, baby, baby. Doo-wop. And it's really funny because I wasn't a doo-wop person. I was one of those tedious jazz people as an adolescent. But all of that melted when it came to social, you know, socializing. You had to get with doo-wop if you wanted to dance and, you know, get a girlfriend or something like that. So this is a poem about that. Imagine it's Detroit right across the river from Windsor, Ontario. Down in one of those basements, rec rooms, there was a rec room fad in the 1950s in American homes, and they ranged all the way from a basement with a coal heater and a couple of folding card tables, you know, that you'd put up to put food and drink on, to very elaborate. But parents who left their kids down there in those rec rooms were crazy. Doo-wop, the moves. Let's make no bones about it, whatever this means or ever meant to you. Darling, you know your way through what I'm about to say. Doo-wop still steals the moment, the sizzling thrill of closeness, the slowness of our touch, too much, too messy to process. Back when dawn rose off the river, we'd feel it. Feel felt like enough when flowering was new and not easy to handle. Neither was breathing. All that light funneling in from Canada ferried over the river while you put a move on my heart. Heart and soul, flesh and bone, doo-wop was known to sabotage. all across the land, white citizens' councils shouted and warned, Negro music is corrupting white youth. Boycott Negro music. We were young, too. You pressed your hand behind my neck. You kissed my mouth. Wham! So who'd kissed whom? You still wonder? In one slow move, you slithered and drizzled snail trails all up and down eroded maps of me. Doo-wop. Stone slow of step sticks to you. Lasts. The doo-wop mind cries, oh, baby, you know I love you. Always thinking of you. I place no one above you. And you know I'll never snub you. Under doo-wop's spell, you make no bones. You shake your perfume booty. You go for keeps. There's a jazz writer named Gene Lees, who's bilingual. He speaks French and English. And he has a book called Singers and the Song, in which he just talks about American singers. And the first chapter in the book is called William and Harold, or How to Write Song Lyrics. Lees has written the lyrics to some songs that you all know. For example, he took Antonio Carlos Jobim's Corcovado and wrote the Quiet Nights lyrics that we know. Quiet nights of quiet stars, quiet chords from my guitar floating on a silence that surrounds us, and so forth. So in this, he says that when in the Norman invasion, an interesting thing happened. The English, what was to become the English language, was Latinized yet again, and enriching English so that, you know, if someone writing in English has, you have choices. You can go French, you can go Anglo-Saxon, you know, you can be hard and dirty and fast, or you can be tender and smooth. Most of our love songs, most of our songs are love songs, and most of our poems are about love, but there are only five words in English that properly rhyme with love. Whereas with amour, as he points out in this delightful essay, there are 85 or 90, so they have a lot more interesting stories. So we're doomed to hear what I just read in that poem. Oh, baby, I'm always thinking of you. Place no one above you. He says that properly, of, the preposition doesn't really go. In American English it works, but it doesn't work in British English because their of sounds more like suave, you know, of, something like that. Pink, full moon. This was written a couple months ago, and there was actually a pink full moon right over here over University Avenue. Pink full moon. Erotic and always under the gun, you're anything but a heated sun. Tonight, the brightness of you, pink and full in this vacuum, could sink the Titanic all over again. Hovering above conversations and covering everything I might rearrange or sight, lose me in your labyrinth of light. And I'm going to go back to a poem. You probably wonder what a poet laureate does. And you're not alone. I'm still wondering myself. But I was commissioned, along with Devorah Major and Janice Mirkatani, to write poems about the opening of the De Young on the 15th of October. And I didn't know I was going to read this, but I'll read it. We each took different approaches to that. This is called Why What You See, Why What You Get, Why You, a celebration of the reopening of the De Young Museum of Fine Arts, 15 October 2005. It opens with an epigraph from Mary MacLean, who's a celebrated Aboriginal painter of Western Australia, and she says, quote, I used to paint dots, very neat ones. Not anymore. Wild woman now. I'd always love that. You know, she got wise to this art thing, you know, just let go. What you see isn't all you get. Night moves the sky of mind aside enough to let imagination gush in. Remember the last time you got quiet, then got high on Mayan, Nubian, African stuff, Grecian, Russian. Remember how the child you stepped through scenes without leaving a trace? Your eye print, all that mattered? Your cave art heart, the clearing ground. Soul cleans away debris so we can see and feel the heart that shattered under a blanket of daylight comes back to us, to hunt us where we live. If you can touch Hatshepsut with an eye, then jump to John Brown just before he'll confront us with his death. Then you can lose the your, the my, and see. You see as us alone. We see as in muse, mausoleum, as in pause, the way each click, each lick, and every breath stitch unhitches, sets free the tiny you, a museum, a memory trace, mere fiction, to make room for death. Can death be more than just another mask? How do the Dogon know so intimately the mysteries of Sirius B, a star astronomers stumbled upon just recently? To log on in real time? Turn up at the Art of Africa, not very far from the pre- and post-amnesiac Americas, or New Guinea, Indonesia, Polynesia, Central Asia, Dreamtime Australia. Wrap your spirit around sculpture the big you already knows by feel and by heart. Why nickel and dime your love-leaning, meaning-hungry, beauty-starved self? Push aside the thinking you enough to stun and wow the being you, a stream of light, wade in the wealth of unfathomable years whose moments you can know only as now. You can tell I'm not comfortable with that yet, but there it is. People have told me that I don't deal with darkness enough in my poetry. These are fellow poets. They say, you know, you really got to get into darkness because that's what people like. So, you know, you listen to people and you say, okay, let's give it a shot. Here's one result. It's a poem called Depression, Blues, Flamenco, Wine, Despair. Depression, blues, flamenco, wine, despair. Sunk in, they make you cross your heart and die for hope. Dark times come at you, they don't care. So deal with this, they say. And so you buy the pain and stress, the restlessness, the works. Low back pain, aches and limps, the twitch of fear your face betrays. John Dizzy Burks Gillespie's cheeks puffed out, fat love and itch scratched by the trumpet at his goateed lip. They said, take chances, stretch, jump at the sun. You just can't spend your whole life acting hip. Be corny sometimes, have yourself some fun. You can't be cool forever, so relax. Diz knew puffed cheeks were anything but chic, but when you closed your eyes, you heard him axe infinitives, split atoms, hairs. You speak that tongue, curves, flatlands, all of it. You do. You understand the hoodoo stab of hurt, the blues, their messy messages, a few trashed hopes, some lame goodbyes, her skirt, your coat, the folded jeans, wet tights, black night is falling all around you in the rain. Dark times can fix you in the light of reason, recognition, lasers, pain. And I think, how are we doing for time? We're about there, aren't we? It's the way I feel. This is the poem that you'll find out there on Addison Street, the Addison Street Project, which Bob Haas and many others worked very hard to bring about. And you go out there sometimes, and somebody is dropped a slice of pizza on your poem, you know. And you look around and nobody knows who you are or what that's all about, but you sort of, you know, move the pizza aside so the people can read what you have. This is the poem you'll find out there from me. It's called Who I Am in Twilight. Like John Lee Hooker, like Lightnin' Hopkins, like the blues himself, the trickster's sonnet, hoedown, the tango, the cante hondo, like blessed spirituals and ragas custom-made, like sagas, like stories, like slick, sly, slow soliloquies sliding into dramas, like crime and punishment, like death and birth, Canal Street, New Orleans, like the easy, erasable, troubled voices a whirling ceiling fan makes in deep summer nights in hot, unheavenly hotels. Oklahoma, Arkansas, Tennessee. Like the Mississippi River so deep and wide you couldn't get a letter to the other side. Like Grand Canyon, like Yosemite National Park, like beans and cornbread, like rest and recreation, like love and like. I know we last. I know this bleeding stops. Thank you. And I'll end with a poem that is not complete yet, but it's complete enough to read. It's called Notes on the Future of Love. The hometown, properly where I was born and spent my first decade, is Ocean Springs, Mississippi, which is right next to Biloxi. And it doesn't exist any longer. It was completely destroyed by Katrina. And so some of that is operating in the back of this. Notes on the Future of Love. Meanwhile, over in yet another time zone, somewhere between Iraq and another place hard hit, the most toxic of gumbos thickens. To the poisoned Kool-Aid taste of homemade sin, answers in progress stack, but don't add up. With every putrid breath you take, hope dissolves into streaming reruns of hell and high water. In Chinese, in Czech, in Arabic or Albanian, in Japanese or German, does the Sermon on the Mount still count? And does it say still, thou shalt not kill? In your cozy time zone, sandwiched now somehow between Iraq and another place hard hit, where do you come down on the future of love? Thank you.
So that concludes this week's edition of Dromotext. We'll be back next week with another hour-long presentation of the spoken word. Tonight we heard Tracy K. Smith and Al Young, both of whom read for the lunchtime poems for the University of California for their lunchtime television series. Till next week.
Red alert. The spread of COVID-19 is at a critical level in your area or a neighboring region. Getting together with family or friends is prohibited, and traveling to other regions is not recommended. More targeted restrictions have been put into place to limit the spread and prevent a lockdown. Learn more at quebec.ca/coronavirus. Continue to wash your hands, keep a 2-meter distance, and wear a mask when physical distancing is impossible. We need to act now. A message from the Gouvernement du Québec.
All right. Directions on how to use your radio. Find the power button. Turn it to on. Turn the knob to CKUT 90.3 FM. Relax and enjoy.
You are listening to CKUT 90.3 FM.
CKUT, we're on the air. I'm the I-5 for CKUT.
CKUT 90.3 FM.
Another reliable communication channel.
Quand vos parents ont besoin d'aide, vous êtes là. Quand vos enfants ont des craintes, vous êtes là. Quand vos amis vivent un moment difficile, vous êtes là. Soyez là pour vous, comme vous l'êtes pour vos proches. C'est possible que la situation actuelle vous fasse ressentir des émotions difficiles ou même de la détresse. Si vous éprouvez de la difficulté à réaliser les actions du quotidien, des solutions existent. Rendez-vous sur québec.ca/allez-mieux ou appelez Info Social 811. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Time.
C is for...
Cauliflower.
Confusion. Creation.
Pickle. K is for...
Kitten.
Cam.
C, wait. Sandroof, C. U, unbearable.
U is for underground.
Oh, yeah.
Umbrella.
T. Trite.
Tremendous.
Torment.
Tire.
C, K...
I can't think of a U one. T.
T.
F is for famous.
Fun. Fumble. M is for... Montreal.